Thank you, Ken, and hello, everyone. It's good to be here with you on this May 20th, 2018, which is hard for me to believe, but that's what happens when you keep busy and keep moving around. The days just fly by, don't they? I'm going to start with a song. I used to be quite the bluegrass fan. There was one year of my life when I spent a significant number of weekends in my life going to bluegrass festivals. And every now and then I enjoy listening to bluegrass again. And the other day I was listening to bluegrass in the car and this song played. And I thought, oh, that's a pretty nice song. So I thought I would play it for you. It's by the Larry Stevenson Band. And the name of the song is Best Laid Plans.
Got a body when I was three. I was stubborn as can be. Thought I didn't need no training wheels. I tore off through the neighborhood. My plan didn't end so good. That day I learned scars take time to heal. When I tried to do things my own way, time to fall flat on my face. Guess I was just too young to understand. Mama would always say to me, what was meant to be will surely be. Sometimes the best laid plans are in God's hands. Just 18 when I left home, thought I could make it on my own. And you know it all, how hard can it be? When you're living fast, you don't take long. Hell, ever since you have is gone. Thank God the folks never turned their backs on me. When I tried to do things my own way, there's times I fall flat on my face. Guess I was just too young to understand. Mama would always say to me, what was meant to be will surely be. And sometimes the best laid plans are in God's hands. Now I've got a family of my own. That was the Lord's plan all along. So I help my kids to understand. Sometimes the best laid plans are in God's hands. When I try to do things my own way, times I fall flat on my face. Guess I'm still too young to understand. Mama's words come back to me. What was meant to be will always be. And sometimes the best laid plans are in God's hands. In God's hands. In God's hands.
So there we go. If we forget. We can remember again. So, What I'm going to do is be sharing from the spiritual teaching of Ramana Maharshi. And I'll be starting on page 42. And last time we were looking at a conversation with a questioner who was, you know, not really questioning about truth. He was questioning about his beliefs. And Ramana was giving him answers. You know, like one of the questions he asked just before we ended was, can you show us the dead? And so what we're doing is we're continuing that conversation. And what he does in this particular question is he uses a word, a Sanskrit word that I've never heard of. So I was just about to look it up last time when I glanced up at the clock and noticed it was time for me to stop. So we'll be beginning with that. We'll begin with looking at this word, finding out what this word means, and then we'll read the question and read the answer. So the word is, I wouldn't even know how to say it. I'm going to say grihastha. It's grihastha. So I'm looking up grihastha. And it's a householder. It's interesting because the song we just sang, I mean, the song we just listened to, he said in the third verse that now he had kids of his own, and he said that was God's plan all along. So in this case, he was a householder, right? He got married, had kids, and he says that was God's plan for him. So this is what a grihastha is. We just had an example of that in our song. How convenient. It's a householder. So the question is, how does a householder fare in the scheme of moksha? And moksha, I'm going to go ahead and look up too. I have a general idea of what that means, but I'm going to go ahead and look it up just to be extra safe here. Moksha is liberation. Yeah, moksha. I thought moksha and mananasa would be the same thing, and I think they are. So liberation. So how does a householder fare in the scheme of liberation? Should he not necessarily become a mendicant, which would be someone who is a beggar or someone who is without any possessions at all? In other words, not a householder. should he not necessarily become a mendicant in order to attain liberation? So again, the question is, how does a householder fare in the scheme of liberation? Should he not become a beggar or one without possessions in order to attain liberation? And this is Ramana Maharshi's answer. Why do you think you are a householder? Similar thoughts that you are a beggar without possessions will haunt you, even if you go out as a beggar without possessions. Whether you continue in the household or renounce it and go to the forest, your mind haunts you. The ego is the source of thought. It creates the body and the world. And it makes you think of being the householder. If you renounce, it will only substitute the thought of beggar for that of householder, and the environment of the forest for that of the household. But the mental obstacles are always there for you. They even increase greatly in the new surroundings. It is no help to change the environment. The one obstacle is the mind. It must be got over, whether in the home or in the forest. If you can do it in the forest, why not in the home? Therefore, why change the environment? Your efforts can be made even now, whatever be the environment. And I just want to say that this is an answer that crosses my mind fairly frequently. You know how there's those certain things that you read or hear along the spiritual path that kind of pop up in your mind as reminders as you go along. And this answer that Ramana Maharshi has given this man is one of those things that pops up for me. Because the mind likes to think that if it were different, you know, if I weren't so busy, if I didn't have this, romantic partner, if I didn't have these responsibilities, if I didn't have this dog, if I had more money, and was more free to go and buy a lovely house in La Vida, I could achieve liberation. You know, I'm reminded of a story that Bob Ferguson told us at the fall retreat this year. At the farm in Virginia, which was really kind of the ashram for the Tat folks back then, when Richard Rose was living. At the farm, they had a cabin, and people could go and stay in the cabin alone for extended lengths of time. You know, kind of temporarily be a one without possessions, right? And Bob talked about how he would go in the cabin, and while he was there, he would find himself imagining how to improve the cabin. And of course, he would come out and he would tell Richard Rose these ideas he had about how to improve the cabin. And Richard Rose told him he was just wasting his time. And that's what Ramana Maharshi is talking about here. The problem is the mind. You know, if you go to your perfect place, the mind goes with you, and it's just going to try and play its tricks there in whatever way it does. You know, for some of us, if you go off into a cabin in the woods, it's going to start worrying about snakes and bears and mountain lions. Oh, my, you know. So some of us are going to go off and have some quiet time in retreat, and that is going to happen. It is going to be a part of our path. But what we want to remember is the location, the physical location, the environment that we are in is not the solution. The solution is letting go of, I'm just going to call it ridiculous thought. The reason I say ridiculous thought is because there is some thought that happens in the course of a day. You know, like if you're a computer programmer and you're creating a program to the specifications of your customer, you know, there's thinking that happens in that process. Even in the creative flow, thinking happens, right? But our real problem is the ridiculous thought. I'm going to tell a story about Jacqueline. She's not here, and I haven't asked her permission, so hopefully she doesn't mind. But, you know, it's something that I have also done. It's just that it hasn't been as recent for me, and I can't remember any of my stories, and I remember hers. But, you know, she bought a house here in November, and then she didn't move here until April. And, of course, by April, we're already into spring. And there's a watering system at her house that didn't get turned on until after she moved here in April. And when she arrived, she looked around and noticed all of the neighbors' trees had already, you know, would you call it bloom when the leaves come out with a tree? I don't know if it's bloom or if it has another word, but, you know, they had already blossomed in that way. The leaves were already there. And she has several lovely trees around her house and nothing. And her mind began to tell her that she had killed all of those lovely trees by waiting till April to come in order to start caring for things. And really, you know, it was a bit of an ego attack. It wasn't a gentle little, oh, you killed the trees. You know, it was the ego being its nasty self. Well, I went away to Yellowstone, as you guys know, and the trees, her trees had not yet blossomed. But when I came back, I went over there yesterday, and her trees are just full and gorgeous. I mean, they really are beautiful, beautiful trees. And so I told her, I said, you know, whenever the ego starts speaking like it did about the trees, I said, just look outside at your trees and realize what a liar it was, you know, because for a week or 2 weeks or however long it was when the ego was telling you that you killed your trees, you know, it was causing you stress and fear and guilt, and there wasn't an ounce of truth to it. Your trees are beautiful, right? They're perfect. So that's an example of ridiculous thought. And we listen to ridiculous thought all the time. And what Ramana Maharshi is saying is if you listen to ridiculous thought as a householder, you're also going to listen to ridiculous thought as a renunciate, unless you learn to renounce the mind. And again, you can renounce the mind, you can renounce ridiculous thought, whether you're a householder or renunciate, right? That doesn't matter. It's wanting to notice the thought is ridiculous, and then choosing not to give it the power of your believing attention. And you can do that whether you're a householder or a renunciate or something somewhere in between, right? So I'll read that question and answer one more time, and then unless something else comes to mind to say, we'll move on. So how does a householder fare in the scheme of liberation? Should he not necessarily become a beggar or one without possessions in order to attain liberation? Ramana's answer. Why do you think you are a householder? Actually, I want to stop right there. I do have something else to say. It's interesting that he begins, why do you think you are a householder? And then he continues in a slightly different vein, and we'll go back to the rest of the answer in a moment. But that's a really good question, just right up at the top. Why do you think you are a householder? I mean, is it true that you are a householder? Or if you happen to be one living in a cave without possessions, is it true that you are a person living in a cave without possessions? Or are you consciousness? Right? What are you? Who am I? This question, why do you think you are a householder, really resembles the who am I question. Who am I? You know, even if I have this role of having a family and working to support my family, what is my identity? Am I actually a householder or am I consciousness? So that first question alone, in answer to this question, is really good to contemplate. That could just make the question itself disappear. Because, of course, if I see myself as consciousness, again, it doesn't matter what's happening in the play of the world. I'm still consciousness. I could be a, quote, renunciate or a, quote, householder, and I'm consciousness, and this is just what's playing out in the world. Right? It doesn't have any real meaning. So again, the question is, how does a householder fare in the scheme of liberation? Should he not necessarily become a beggar or one without possessions in order to attain liberation? Ramana Maharshi, why do you think you are a householder? Similar thoughts that you are a beggar will haunt you, even if you go out as a beggar. Whether you continue in the household or renounce it and go to the forest, your mind haunts you. The ego is the source of thought. It creates the body and the world, and it makes you think of being the householder. Again, this is another point worth pausing. You know, we often did I say often forget that the world is not real? The world is a projection of consciousness, right? It's a projection of the focus of consciousness. And so one thing that it says in NTI, back in NTI Matthew, is it says that you must accept that the world is not real. And it's always been interesting to me that that's right up front in NTI. NTI doesn't wait to get into the much later chapters, you know, like Thessalonians or Hebrews or something like that, to say, okay, now that I've given you all of this teaching, you must accept that the world is not real. It says it right there in Matthew, in the very, very first portion of the book. Why is that? The answer, which I understood immediately when I wrote that sentence as the scribe, is because if I don't accept that the world is not real, if I choose to see the world as real, I'm not going to change my mind about it. Instead, I'm going to react to it as if it's real, right? I'm going to manage money problems the way a person who believes in the world manages money problems. I'm going to manage relationship problems the way a person who believes in the world manages relationship problems. I'm going to manage health problems the way a person in the world manages health problems. And what's interesting is I'm not a person in the world. I'm consciousness. But what I'm doing as I'm believing the world is real and as I'm believing that I'm a person in the world, what I'm doing as consciousness is I'm focusing my attention on these beliefs, and I'm, you could say, I'm creating an imprint on consciousness. And then as the light of consciousness shines through that imprint, those same manifestations continue to show up in the same way, right? So you could say that I am creating the exact problems I am trying to manage. And again, a problem may be temporarily resolved, but then in another way, in another place, maybe even with another person, it shows up again. It doesn't disappear, because as consciousness, we're believing that the world is real. We're reacting to them as if we're a person in the world. And what we really are is consciousness. And with the focus of our attention, we just continue to create those same illusions. And the only way that we're going to stop being that way is if we accept that the world is not real. You know, one of my biggest problems when I was earlier on the spiritual path going through my purification period, one of my biggest problems was money. By that I mean one of my biggest fears. I just want to point out, I've actually never had a money problem. I have never in my entire life been without. Okay? And I think it's probably true of a lot of people who think they have money problems, right? It's really all in the head. It's all imagination. But at that time, you know, that was the perception, was that I didn't have the money. The money was running out. And I remember one time, I don't know exactly when it was. You know, it might have been after I finished writing NTI. I think it was, but I don't know that for sure. So if you ever hear an older audio and I tell the story a little differently, the older audio is more accurate because I was closer to when it happened. Now, you know, it's a little funky because of memory. I'll remember the main points perfectly, but some of the details are a little hazy. I think it might have been after I finished writing NTI. And prior to leaving my job, prior to having that guidance to leave my job and move to North Carolina, I was a director of a department in a nationwide company. So I had a pretty good, pretty high-level job. And, you know, I left that and moved to North Carolina and wrote NTI. But these money fears just, you know, never really left, because all of my life I was writing checks to put money in savings or in the 401k, and now suddenly I'm writing checks to take money out of the savings and out of the 401k and watching everything dwindle down, and it was really fearful for me. So whenever this was, I'll say when I finished writing NTI, these fears are still here with me. And so one day I really did feel guided to go ahead and open up the paper and look at the want ads. I had been not doing it in spite of my fear, because I knew I was guided to move to North Carolina, and I knew I was guided to write NTI. So, you know, I ignored, you know, I practiced rest, accept, and trust. But when I say I ignored my fears, I mean that I didn't follow them up. I wasn't looking for a job. I was getting up every morning and writing NTI, right? But on this day, I felt guided, actually guided, to go ahead and look at the want ads. And I was in a little bitty town in North Carolina, and there were never good jobs around there. I mean, you know, jobs were like truck driver training and waitress and, you know, stuff like that. But I open up, and there's this job, a director position. I think it might have been for the local Red Cross office, but I don't remember exactly now. But when I read the qualifications, I mean, I was the perfect person for the job. And I'm in this little bitty town where I'm guessing I don't have a lot of competition. You know, there aren't many people who have done all of the things this job required, you know, like writing budgets and managing employees and hiring and firing and, you know, this whole list of stuff that I had done and was quite good at. The next thing I felt was, I don't remember if it was the cover letter or the resume, but I felt to write one, you know, like maybe it was update the resume and then write the cover letter and then put them in an envelope, address it, get in the car, drive to the post office. And I was on my way to the post office with this resume and cover letter and absolute certainty that I would get this job. Right? When I heard clear as day, you can return to the world or you can continue this journey with me. What do you want? I mean, it was just so amazing. Like I was led right to, you know, you can go right back, right here. I'm handing it to you. You did what I asked. You left your job. You wrote NTI. And now you can go right back if you want to. I'm handing it to you on a platter. But what do you want? And I threw the resume and the cover letter in the trash. I never applied for the job. And interestingly, it wasn't long after that when I saw a documentary of Buddha's life. And as you all know, Buddha started off as Prince Siddhartha. And he was a prince in line to be king. And he had a wife who had just had a baby. And there was a point in his life where he met a woman whose father was a king. And she invited him back to their palace for dinner one night. And Prince Siddhartha went back. This was before the Enlightenment. But I think he was, what was his name then? Gautama? I think his name was Gautama at that time. He went with the woman back to the palace and ate with the king. And the king invited him to marry his daughter and become next in line, you know, the heir to this king. It's just the exact same thing. Like, here, I give it all right back to you right now, God's saying. You know, you can take it all. You can go back to your old life or you can continue with me. And, of course, as you know, Buddha walked away from that and continued. So, why would we make those types of choices? Why would Regina Dawn Akers and Buddha, in spite of whatever was going on with them at the time, you know, in my case, lots and lots of fear about money, and I'm offered this perfect opportunity to go back and have a good job and, you know, with God basically saying, thank you for doing what you did. The answer to that, at least in my case, I can't speak for Gautama, I had in me a desire to actually learn from my own direct experience that the world was not real. And I knew that if I went back to my old way of being, sure, I would feel safe, but I'd never learn that lesson. You know, if I went back to being a director, I'd never learn the lesson that the world wasn't real. I knew that if I was to learn this, really, really learn this, I had to continue with the Holy Spirit, even though the Holy Spirit was not telling me how I was going to be safe. Right? I had to continue with the Holy Spirit, and I had to watch it unfold in ways that I could never imagine in order to learn that the world is not real. In other words, the goal was to see that the truth is true. Not just believe it, but have a direct experience of it. And that's why I threw that resume and that cover letter in the trash. And it was interesting because around that same time, and I may have even told this story when I was teaching, and that might be what instigated it, but I don't know that for a fact, so that's another one of the fuzzy details. But around the same time, a lot of people in Paltalk, at that time it was ACIM Gather, but a lot of people got really angry at me. And they were telling me, Regina, just go get a job. You know, they were scared for me. But I think this was after I'd already made the decision, probably after I'd already thrown the cover letter and the resume in the trash, because their fear, and there were several of them, wasn't just one or two, their fear and their insistence that I go get a job, to me, at that point, was merely lack of faith. Like I guess when I threw that resume and that cover letter in the trash, I crossed some kind of a threshold because now their fear couldn't scare me. I wasn't joining them. It was more like old echoes of a fear I had and I no longer had. And I even remember at a gathering in Texas, I was telling a similar story, maybe even telling this very story. And by now I had the guidance to move to Pueblo, and of course moving costs money. And I just didn't know how I was going to be okay. But at this point I had this knowing that I was. I didn't know how. I knew that I was. I knew that the world was not real. And that if I followed guidance, things would unfold to take care of even the body me, right? And I just didn't have to worry about it. And I remember someone raised their hand and asked, how do you know you'll be okay? And I remember my answer was, I can't answer that. All I can say is watch me for a year and we'll find out together. So I guess what I'm saying is, you know, Ramana Maharshi says here, the ego is the source of thought. It creates the body and the world, and it makes you think of being a householder, right? Someone with bills and responsibilities and all of that. And I guess what I'm saying is if we continue believing our role in the world and our apparent problems in the world and our apparent ideas of how we survive, and we keep acting those out, we never learn they aren't true. We keep reinforcing them by continuing to act them out. And so when the guidance comes to make a change, and I want to emphasize that, when the guidance comes to make a change, because Ramana Maharshi is telling us right here, you don't have to make a change. You can let go of your thoughts right where you're at. And that's true. We don't want to forget that point. Start letting go of your thoughts right where you're at. But my experience is somewhere along the way, there's guidance to make some kind of a change. It's different for every person what that might be. But something comes that we're afraid of. And that's when we really want to ask ourselves, what do I want? Do I want to continue to believe that the world is real and it works the way I've always thought it works? Or do I want to follow this guidance and discover what's true? Discover that the truth is different than what I've always believed. Now, in this particular case, it's kind of funny because the beliefs are I can't be a householder and wake up. That's a typical Hindu belief. You know, I need to become a mendicant. I need to renounce possessions and become a beggar, right? And so here, by telling the man to stay as a householder, he's actually teaching the man to let go of his belief system. The world does not work the way you think it does. You know, you do not need to become a spiritual mendicant. You do not need to become a beggar, one without possessions, live in a cave in order to be liberated. The world is not real. And the idea that you are a householder and the idea that spiritual enlightenment works the way you think spiritual enlightenment does is all just a projection of the ego. And to find out that that's true, why don't you stay right where you're at? Don't follow the ways you think you have to follow in order to be enlightened. Stay right where you're at. Practice self-inquiry. And notice you can become enlightened in place, right? And this is why every path is different. Every path is different because our beliefs that need to be undone aren't the same. They have the same source, the ego, fear, guilt, and unworthiness, right? They have the same source, but they're not the same. I recently, while I was in Yellowstone over vacation, read a book called How to Bust Loose from the Business Game. And in that book, he had this great example. He said, you know, have you ever watched people build a building? Like imagine somebody building like a 10-story building. You know, that takes a long time to build a 10-story building, right? Months. And then he said, have you ever watched somebody, you know how they blow up a building and let it collapse when they want to build something else there? Have you ever watched anybody do that? And he says it only takes seconds. You know, it takes seconds for them to destroy the building that took, you know, months or maybe even years to build. And he said that's really the way it is kind of with our ego. He says that it takes, you know, years and years and years to build the ego. But it can actually be deconstructed fairly quickly, you know, and in my case, I always say it was about 5 years. But 5 years compared to 50 years of building it, that's pretty quick. But he said in order for that ego to be deconstructed so quickly, he says you have to trust what he calls your higher self and follow its guidance. Because when they you know, explode one of those buildings, or really it's implode one of those buildings. He said the experts that do it, they know right where to put the dynamite. They don't have to put the dynamite next to every single brick in the building. They know the strategic places to put the dynamite so that when they blow it up, the building will collapse. Your higher self or your inner teacher or your spiritual wisdom knows exactly how to do that with you. It knows exactly what situations to guide you into that will bring up your foundational beliefs, put the dynamite in there, and explode it so that your ego collapses really fast. And again, really fast, maybe 5 years or so. Not instantly in a lot of cases, but compared to how long it took to build it, really fast. But he emphasized that in order for that to happen, you have to be willing to follow the guidance. And I think he even emphasized, if I remember correctly, that you have to want to learn that the world is not real. So, that's an important point. That's an important motivation. That's an important spiritual aspiration. to want to learn that the truth is true, also known as to want to learn that the world is not real. To want to learn that I am consciousness, also known as learning I am not a person. And therefore being willing to follow whatever guidance comes to me because of the way I need to be undone. And not expect my path to look like somebody else's. Right? My higher self, my spiritual intuition is putting the dynamite where it needs to be for me to be undone. And I need to trust that guidance and follow that guidance. Don't you think it's so funny that I would be guided all the way to writing a cover letter and a resume and driving to the post office when I'm told, you know, you can go back or you can continue this path with me. And it all comes down to what do I really want? Safety? Security? Or to find out that the truth is true. So let's go back to this question and answer. That was a little bit off to the side, but maybe important. So again, how does a householder fare in the scheme of liberation? Should he not necessarily become a beggar or one without possessions in order to attain liberation? Ramana Maharshi says, why do you think you are a householder? Right? How do we identify ourselves? Why do you think you are a householder? Similar thoughts that you are a renunciate will haunt you, right? If you give up your possessions and move out to the forest, now it's going to be, I am a renunciate. That identification is still going to be there. Similar thoughts that you are a renunciate will haunt you even if you go out as a renunciate. Whether you continue in the household or renounce it and go to the forest, your mind haunts you. The ego is the source of thought. It creates the body and the world, and it makes you think of being a householder. It helps you identify with your role, with your experience. If you renounce, it will only substitute the thought of renunciate for that of householder. You'll just have a new identification. And the environment of the forest for that of the household, right? It will substitute one environment for another. But the mental obstacles are always there for you. They even increase greatly in the new surroundings. It is no help to change the environment. The one obstacle is the mind. It must be got over, whether in the home or in the forest. If you can do it in the forest, why not in the home? And in fact, one rule that I've followed ever since I've been on this spiritual path is where I am and what I'm doing and who I'm with is the default unless I receive guidance to do something else. You know, I'm not going to be like, oh, I'm dissatisfied with my partner. Let me find another partner. I'm dissatisfied with my job. Let me find another job. I'm dissatisfied with my home. Let me find another home. I'm not doing that type of seeking. I choose to stay right where I am, with who I'm with, unless I receive clear guidance to make a change. And then I make a change. And I've always thought that that was a very helpful rule because so many people are seeking change. You know, that's really what's happening here. This householder thinks that he needs to leave his wife and children in order to become spiritually liberated. He's seeking change. And Ramana is saying, stay where you're at. And yet, Ramana himself was guided as a teenager to leave the life that would have led to being a householder and to become a renunciate. Right? So here we have a renunciate telling a householder, stay where you're at. But I think stay where you're at unless clearly guided otherwise is a pretty good rule. Because then we're not seeking outwardly for something that we think is a better situation. And then if you stay where you're at and your partner gets on your nerves, you use that for healing. If you stay where you're at and your responsibilities start annoying you, you use that for healing. Another quick story. We may not get through this simple question with all of my stories. But another quick story early on my spiritual path, like in the first month, I believe. My boyfriend got transferred out to Colorado. We were living in Massachusetts at the time. And I had wanted to live in Colorado most of my adult life. Like, that was the place I wanted to go. And he asked me if I would come with him. And again, I had this good job at the time. I was a director. Jasmine was going to this great school, the second best school district in the United States. And this was the best elementary school in that school district. She had to win a lottery to get in. But I was a brand new course student, and what I wanted to do was focus on the course. So I told Ron, if you'll marry me and support me so I don't have to work, you know, I'll pay cash for a house out there so we don't have a mortgage, and I'll go. Well, it didn't work out that way. You know, as we got closer to the time when those changes would make, Ron made it clear that he didn't want to do that. But by then, it was April when the plan was put in place, and it was September, I think, when I realized this wasn't going to happen. So I continued in my job, and everything stayed the same, and Ron moved out to Colorado. And I remember one day at work, I don't remember what was going on, but stuff always goes on at work. And I was frustrated and just didn't feel like what I wanted. And I said out loud, I said, why do I have to be here? And I heard the song in my mind, just this one line. It's from New York, New York. If I can make it here, I can make it anywhere. And I knew that that meant that I needed to practice healing right where I was. I couldn't run away from my perceived problem life to a perceived dream life and heal, which is really what this guy wants to do. In my case, it was run to Colorado, my dream state, and not have to work anymore and be able to study the course every day. That wasn't the answer. I needed to heal right here where I had always been. And I remember also around that time I went to a meeting. We had these leadership meetings for directors, vice presidents, and the CEO. We were called the leadership team. And there were about 40 of us on the leadership team because we were a pretty big company. And, of course, I worked at this place for 9 years, and I knew all of these people really well. And I had, been through all kinds of business problems with every single person on the team. And so I went to this meeting, this leadership meeting, and I sat there looking around the table at these 40 faces. And I thought, oh, my God, there isn't a single person here I like. I have business grievances with every single person here. No wonder I have to stay here and heal first. I've got work to do. And so I started immediately doing that work. And I would watch my mind like crazy, and I would do root cause inquiry with the thoughts and the feelings that would come up regarding the different people and the different situations. And I just went to work like crazy. I also did it in a fairly bold way, in that I started scheduling, I think it was 2 appointments a week, lunch appointments, with someone that I didn't like. I say, oh, I really don't like her. Okay, I'm going to ask her out to lunch. Oh, boy, I can't stand him. Okay, I'm going to ask him out to lunch. And I would. I would ask him out to lunch, and I would sit there with them. And as they would talk and be themselves and say all the things that would trigger me, I would sit across the table from them practicing forgiveness, looking at my mind, noticing my thoughts about what was being said, my judgments, practicing rest, accept, and trust, letting go, right? You could say I started really working my butt off at the place where I always worked. Within 9 months, every one of my relationships transformed. I really liked all of these people. And not only that, they liked me. I remember one lady saying to me, "You know, Regina, I used to not like you at all, but now I don't remember why." And people would schedule one-on-one meetings with me in my office. I had a really nice corner office. They would schedule one-on-one meetings with me in my office. When we got inside and closed the door, they'd ask, "What's going on with you? What's changing? You know, I see this change. You're so happy. And what's going on?" And I spent, in my last months at work, I would spend sometimes up to 5-6 hours a day, still getting paid my director's salary, sitting behind closed doors, telling people about A Course in Miracles. But you know when that guidance came to quit my job and to move to North Carolina? It was after I had done my work where I was. Right? I was the one that wanted to run away from where I was because I thought where I was a problem. And if I went somewhere else, it would be better. And the guidance was just like the guidance Ramana Maharshi is giving. The guidance was to stay where I was and do the work that had to be done there. Once the work that had to be done there was done, well, you know, I wasn't liberated. There was additional work to do. I needed to learn that the world was not real. Then came the guidance to leave the job, right? Because that's not having a job was the next big step for me. But see, guidance knows where to put the dynamite in order to take down our ego. And guidance knows not only what situations we have to be put in order for those beliefs to be brought up and healed, but it also knows what order. And so our job is to not think it has to look a certain way. I don't have to leave my job because Regina left her job, or I don't have to become a renunciate because Ramana Maharshi became a renunciate. What I have to do is the more important thing that Regina and Ramana did, and that's follow guidance. And my guidance knows where to put the dynamite to bring down my ego. So again, why do you think you are a householder? Similar thoughts that you are a renunciate will haunt you, even if you go out as a renunciate. Whether you continue in the household or renounce it and go to the forest, your mind haunts you. The ego is the source of thought. It creates the body and the world. And it makes you think of being the householder. If you renounce, it will only substitute the thought of householder. It will only substitute the thought of renunciate for that of householder, and the environment of the forest for that of the household. But the mental obstacles are always there for you. They even increase greatly in new surroundings. It is no help to change the environment. The one obstacle is the mind. It must be got over, whether in the home or in the forest. If you can do it in the forest, why not in the home? If I can make it here, I can make it anywhere. Therefore, why change the environment? Your efforts can be made even now, whatever be the environment. So again, maybe one reason change isn't happening for you right now is because you need to heal right where you're at. There's too many things right there that are useful to you. And when that environment is no longer useful to your awakening, then you will be guided to another environment. You're always going to be guided to whatever supports you best in your decision to awaken. There's only 4 minutes left. So although this entire song doesn't fit well, this is the song that that came to my mind that helped me realize why I needed to stay at work and couldn't move to Colorado and become a full-time course student. So why didn't we listen to it in our last few minutes? It's New York, New York with Frank Sinatra. And again, the entire song doesn't really fit. It was really that line, but what the heck. Let's listen to the song. Here we go.
Spreading the news, I'm leaving today. I want to be a part of it. New York, New York. These vagabond shoes are longing to stray right through the very heart of it. New York, New York. I want to wake up in a city that doesn't sleep and find I'm king of the hill, top of the heap. These little town blues are melting away. I'll make a brand new start of it in old New York. If I can make it there, I'll make it anywhere. It's up to you, New York, New York.
That the song played that, it played a little differently in my head because it's if I can make it there, I can make it anywhere. And when I heard it back then, it was if I can make it here, I can make it anywhere. That's why I needed to stay right where I was at. I have a P.S. here from Tricky Vicky. My brother's business is with implosions. Oh, you described the art and science of it to a T. So her brother actually does that, destroys buildings. Yeah, that's interesting. Oh, that's Anne. Anne said that, not Tricky Vicky. Anne. Yeah. All right, I'm letting go of the mic. See y'all later.